I blinked. His head had been swallowed by the airbag. Chapter 19. Finn? I threw my arm out and slapped his shoulder, adrenaline clumsy. Shit! Finn! He jerked back, gasping, a diver coming up for air. Are you dead? The question was redundant, but he assured me he wasn't dead anyway, and I told him that neither was I. Neither of us was even hurt, and the car was fine. We were both very surprised. I was so surprised that I was trembling too much to drive for a while. So we sat quietly. Cohen folded the airbag neatly and sat it on the dashboard like a dishcloth he wanted to dry. He kept saying it would be all right, like an idiot. He was trying to be reassuring, but all I heard was how naive he was and how I shouldn't have bothered force-feeding him in the restaurant. He had been pictured with me. He had no idea of the shitstorm we were in. Teagler didn't care about truth. No one did. And what was Trina Keeney doing telling the truth in a world where that would get you killed in a house fire? We were in terrible danger. She was powerful and vicious. But Finn thought I was upset about Hamish and Estelle, and I did him the kindness of letting him think that. He said that they had been having an affair for months. I think I knew that. He knew from the start, and he had stayed away from me because he didn't want to be implicated in their deceit. It started when he was first hospitalised.
My eating removes me from life sometimes. I wasn't there for her, he said.
I looked at him and said it was kind of obvious. He nodded, ashamed. All of that seemed very small and luxurious, so I said, well, we've all got our thing.
I heard you read obsessively. I snapped angrily. Is that what she says?
Unwilling to fight, he held his hands up in surrender and looked away. He took a deep breath. I looked out of the windscreen. The night was pitch black. I must have slapped the headlights off. The only sign of civilization, a little window of yellow light far up a distant hill. Above us, the dark sky was a blanket of fulminating charcoal. My girls would find out what they did to me, those men. Those things they did to me back then. My little girls. I wanted them ignorant and innocent. I wanted them to go swimming and eat vegetables. That past life had felt like something vivid but imagined. Something that happened to someone else centuries ago. Only now it wasn't. The break between my two lives had been so complete. I was just dealing with what was before me, not what was behind me, day to day, hitting my marks.
I mean, Anna,
Finn said carefully,
you will meet someone else. You're still an attractive woman.
The whole situation was suddenly absurd. Sitting in a crashed car with a starving man and my life shattered, Gretchen fucking Teagler back in my life, and Leon dead.
But Finn thought I could still pull. There was always that.
Absurd. I started laughing and sobbing. Great bubbles of snot bursting from my nose. I banged the steering wheel with an open palm until it hurt. This went on for a long time until the skin was raw. Finn Cohen sat still. He reached forward at one point and touched the carefully folded airbag as if to check it wasn't going to blow up in his face again. Finally, I managed to stop laughing. I wasn't shaking anymore either. I wiped my face dry with my sleeve and looked out of the window. God, what a fucking mess. I want a cigarette. I didn't say it to him, I just said it. He reached into his pocket and took out a beige leather tobacco pouch, a flat wallet held closed with a thong. It was quite a beautiful thing, old, very soft and smooth. He rolled a very thin cigarette and gave it to me and lit it for me with a lighter. Some cigarettes are nice. Some are exquisite. This was more than that. It was a reunion with my old badass self. I hadn't smoked since I left Skibo. I breathed in, drawing grey stain down through my lungs, enjoying the damage it was doing me. Could I disappear again? Just run away and start again for a third time? But Precious' photograph showed my front door. That's where they would look for me, and if they didn't find me, they would find my girls. I could go ahead and kill myself. That seemed reasonable for a second. But then I realised that Precious' photo would be the last sighting of me. The tweets below told the story of who I had been. Hamish would find out about my past, and one day he'd have to tell the girls. When they grew up, they'd go looking for me and read the newspapers and the court reports. That's how they would remember me. Not kissing their hair or cupping warm water to rinse soap suds off their little backs. Not waiting at the school gate in the rain for them. They'd remember their mother as beaten and victimised. A troubled fantasist, a lonely drunk, mad. No wonder she killed herself. And I'd seen how my dad's suicide hollowed out my mum, how hard it was for her to get past it. Because of what he'd done, suicide was my reflexive thought when I was in a corner. I'd be passing that on to them. What else could I do? I couldn't ask the police for help. Gretchen Tiegler was too powerful. I wanted to slap her, run at her and slap her face. It gave me a little lift to think that. I'd been running away from her for 9 years and thought about running towards her. Turn up on her doorstep and confront her. There would be no reason to go after the girls if I turned up at her door. It was dangerous, but remember, I was suicidal. It was a fantasy at that point. She was reclusive and paranoid. I didn't think I would get anywhere near her. I asked Finn for another cigarette and he gave me one. I smoked and imagined Tiegler's face, her cheek pinking from a slap, what I might say to her. "We need petrol," I said, restarting the car. I backed out of the ditch, the wheels scattering stones over the tarmac. "Headlights," said Finn. "Oh yeah," I said, flicking them on, "because then we'll be safe." We drove in silence. I was exhausted, lost in thought, almost relieved, to be honest, contemplating something life-threateningly reckless. I've met people that nothing much ever happened to. They live in the same place, they go on holiday, come back, eat food day after day, no ups, no downs. I used to wonder if they were lying or unobservant or had somehow arranged their fate that way. But it's just random, dumb luck. Too much has happened to me. Too many lives, too many events. I can't take in any more. "Why do you read all the time?" Finn's voice startled me. I'd actually forgotten he was there. "I don't read all the time. Sometimes I listen to audiobooks."
"Estelle said you read while you were changing for yoga, and sometimes she'd leave you at home and come back hours later and you'd still be in the hall with her coat on, reading."
"Isn't it good to read?"
"Isn't it good to watch her wait?"
That was unexpected. He was making a joke. I asked, "When did your food thing start?" He sighed.
"The band got big. Everything went crazy. I just got focused on that one thing. I could control it and I couldn't control anything else. It's hard to feel so judged and criticised when your identity is just starting to form."
"No carapace," I said, and he liked that. I told him that I read to self-medicate, that I find the world a bit much sometimes. Podcasts are like reading when you need to use your eyes and hands, And he said, yeah, yeah, that's kind of what his eating was like, self-medicating. But then it took over and he couldn't stop.
It's a chemical spiral. It gets so that it feels like the only thing that matters, controlling it. Eating isn't like a book, though. You can't just put it down.
I didn't say so, but I've read books I couldn't put down. Not always because they were good, either. I just couldn't stop reading. Once I was reading a book and finished it by mistake. I hadn't noticed the last 140 pages were an index, and then had nothing to read. In a blind panic, I went back to the start and read it again. Well, I said, at least you've got one thing that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
He smiled at me.
I've got one comfort and it's killing me. It's also public. It feels as if there are lots of consequences. People see it, young people. And when I'm failing, I feel responsible for things I can't control. And I don't want being sick to be all I'm known for, you know? Being ill to be the only thing I put out in the world.
Maybe you like the attention.
Shy man in a spotlight. Not sure I do.
He was quoting their biggest hit at me, which I thought was quite crass. Why did you come to my door, Finn? He shrugged.
I was walking around for hours feeling sorry for myself. I've been trying to be less self-obsessed. I was nearby, so I tried to think about someone else. It's part of my spiritual practice, trying to be other-centred.
Does it work?
Sometimes. I'm here. I could still be out walking and hating myself.
And instead, look at all the fun we've had. There have been fights, you've been threatened with chicken, and we've had a car crash.
A smashing day out. You're pretty obsessed with that podcast. What's that about?
Well, I was too tired to make up a story, so I just told him the truth. That I met Leon when I worked in a hotel, and how I just liked him and felt he was being maligned in the podcast. That Leon was nice, a bit daft, a bit feckless, but not overtly nasty. Gretchen Tiegler was a bag of poison. She'd destroyed lives before I knew she had, but she was so powerful that no one ever said anything. As I told him this, I felt my craving to see Adam Ross grow. Adam, who could read between lines and didn't need everything explained to him in exhaustive detail. I drove on and got Finn to watch the dive film. It freaked him out so much that he made me pull over for a minute. It was probably more intense for him because he was watching it in a moving car and it was dark outside and his body was eating itself. Did you see the light coming from the boy's mouth? He nodded.
Is he speaking?
No, it's a reflection of the diver's light from his head torch.
I'm going to be sick.
But he wasn't sick. We waited until he felt better before driving on. When we got going again, I told him Gretchen Tiegler was almost certainly responsible for Amila taking the blame. She had blocked investigations before. She was rich and powerful and thought she was above the law.
Did you meet her at the hotel?
No, I've had dealings with her but never met her.
You have any evidence against her?
She doesn't leave evidence. He didn't seem convinced. It did sound a bit mad. I told him to look at the photo of Leon and his kids on the website. He did and said,
oh God, look at them.
I loved the way he said that. As if he really looked at them, read their gestures, saw the tender interplay. I took a left at a deserted crossroad. And that was taken an hour before he's supposed to have killed them. I mean, does that look like a man who's planning to kill them? Finn was still looking at the picture. It doesn't, does it? I continued. He's smiling, he's happy. The daughter Violetta, she's wearing the necklace he bought her. Look at those gorgeous kids, how proud Leon is of them. He hesitated and then said,
who took the picture?
What?
They're all holding champagne glasses, you can see everyone's hands, no one's using a selfie stick, the phone isn't resting on anything so it's not on a timer. If only the three of them were alone on board, who took the picture?
Chapter 20. Parts of Fort William had been pedestrianised since I was last there, and the road system was unfamiliar. We had to park quite far away, but I found Adam Ross's door by memory. It had been several lifetimes since I was there. His flat was on the top floor of a converted Georgian merchant's villa, overlooking a beautiful little square. The council had tried to make the space into a gathering point for locals, furnishing it with plant pots, paving and a large steel bench in the shape of a comfy Chesterfield sofa. The steel sofa had little puddles all over it and represented the hollow hope of comfort afforded by the square itself, which was a conduit for winds and whipping rain. We stood in the bitter cold and looked up to dirty windows with rotting curtains sagging in them. I had a sick feeling Adam was dead. His health was precarious, by which I mean he was a lifelong heroin addict. The front door was heavy and low, down a step from the street because the floor of the square had been built up over the years. His name was still on the door. I pressed the buzzer. No answer.
"Not in?" asked Finn.
I was so far back in time in such a specific set of emotional memories that I was annoyed to find Finn with me. He stood with one hand tucked into the pocket of his jacket, just the fingertips, as if he was modelling in a catalogue. He was shivering from his belly again, embarrassed about it again. "Are you shivering because you're too thin?" He looked scared. "I'm not gonna nag you, just tell me. We'll get you some jumpers or something." The door buzzer suddenly echoed around the empty square, amplified on shop windows and the steel sofa, sounding as if it was coming from all around us. I pushed and the door fell open and down, sagging on loose hinges. We stepped into the concrete close. When the housing association bought the house, they kept the facade but rebuilt everything else. The close floor was concrete, painted oxblood red up to waist level. The stairs, which I suppose were once an elegant twist around the turn of a hall, were squared off and paired with a plastic banister. The downstairs light bulb was out, and we ascended from the dark into a soft light. Adam Ross was standing on the landing, hanging over the banister, too excited to wait indoors, same as always. He was grinning wide, showing his bad teeth.
"Annie, ya fanny,"
he called down on my head.
"How old are you now?"
"Adam, look at the wrinkles on me," I said gleefully, lifting my hair to show my washboard forehead.
"Mental," he grinned,
meaning an old friend from a decade ago appearing on the doorstep at 10 o'clock on a midweek night.
"You're a middle-aged housefrau who's losing her looks."
"My man just left me for someone younger," I said, and we both laughed. Lovely thing about Adam, and why I loved him, was that he was kind to me when it mattered, and he had seen a lot too. It's hard to be among vanilla bastards all the time. Normal people can get genuinely upset about a bad haircut, cross words, sick cats. It's hard not to roll your eyes and say the wrong thing. I often said the wrong thing. Wake up, shut up, grow up. These are the wrong things to say when people are sad about some minor cruelty or sentimental incident. But Adam Ross was as damaged as me. He didn't need to be shielded or protected, and he knew what not to pick at. A fellow traveller. You could say anything to him. That is rare and very precious. Most of us demand a tiptoe or two. I hadn't really driven all the way here for information I could probably find on the internet. I really just wanted to get out of there and to rest my eyes on Adam. I'm struggling to describe his appearance. You know when you squeeze a tea bag out and leave it in the sink? It looks spent and crumpled. But if you leave it in the sink to dry out for days, perhaps in a warm environment, it becomes almost unrecognisable as an ex-teabag. The edges bleach to white. The inside desiccates. These sorts of things had happened to Adam. I think we had both assumed the drugs would have killed him by now. He worked as crew on private yachts, then as a sailing instructor, then a fisherman, and then a trawlerman. These are not careers enhanced by the use of soporifics. I worried about Adam and checked him out on Facebook every so often. He only posted when he got clean. His timeline read like a digital clock that needs new batteries. 90 days, 7 days, 24 hours, 1 year, 90 days. The comments below were always positive and encouraging, but over the years the supportive comments grew fewer, got shorter, and more formulaic. Like most addicts, he was fucking infuriating. How do I look? He held his skinny arms out and pulled some bodybuilder poses. Spiffy as ever, but honestly, Adam, really quite fucked. Oh, I know. Thanks anyway. Come away in. He stepped back to let me through, saw Finn on the stairs and blinked hard at the sight of him. Is that Finn Cohen? Cohen didn't know what to say. He looked to me for guidance, but I didn't know either. I went into the flat. Adam's girlfriend had been living with him when I knew him before. I used to visit them, but all her stuff was gone now. I wanted to ask about her, but couldn't remember her name. The flat was very tidy. Everything was in neat piles, and the carpet had track marks from a Hoover. Finn and I walked into the vibrant orange living room and sat down next to each other on the sofa. Adam stood in the doorway, rubbing his hands together, pretending that Finn Cohen wasn't sitting in his house. Well, can I get you a wee cup of tea and a biscuit, maybe? No, Adam, I just wanted to ask you about something technical. Good, he said, because I don't have any biscuits or tea or coffee. Then he stood in front of us, crossed his ankles and dropped, cross-legged, to the floor. Do you remember Leon Parker? Did he work at the castle with us? No, he was a guest there with a club member called Lily Harkan. She was Dutch, very good looking, snippy. Don't remember either of them. Did they come sailing with me?
I don't think so.
Ah, I wouldn't know them then. Does Mackay know you're about?
Albert Mackay.
He asked after you when you left, earwigging for snippets. Even asked me once if I ever heard from you, which, you know, it's big for him.
Albert Mackay was not known for being emotionally engaged, but he took an interest in me for some reason. He was the manager of the castle. When he sacked me, he did so reluctantly. He said I did not have the right personality for service, which I considered a great compliment. He said we had to be nice to our guests, meaning we shouldn't hit them. Still, he'd always given me references afterwards, and many of them were glowing enough to verge on the fraudulent. I was thinking about going to see him.
He'd love that,
nodded Adam.
What do you want to know about sailing anyway?
I told him about Leon's yacht, a 60-foot schooner, how he was supposed to have cast off himself. Adam said, yeah, you could do that alone. It's not that complicated. I said that he hadn't turned the navigation lights on, had left the radio off and sailed out to the Bay of Biscay at night. Adam said that was dangerous. I said, I know, they all died. Had Adam seen the insurance company film of the wreck? They found the family's bodies in the dining room. Christ no, he said, sailors don't watch shit like that, that's for civvies. I said, okay, here's something I was wondering about. Leon paid the crew in cash at the start of the voyage. Adam waited, turned his head sharply, tipping his ear towards me, waiting for more. He tittered,
what?
He paid them in cash at the start of the voyage. He snorted and shook his head.
No, I didn't.
He definitely did. Adam shook his head and wrinkled his nose.
What?
He gave them full payment up front. He laughed.
No one would ever do that. You get paid monthly into a bank account from an offshore company. Do you know who crews these boats? Folk like me. Would you give me cash and expect to see me again? But Adam, you're... I didn't know how to formulate it so it didn't sound derogatory. A drug addict? A junkie? I hate that word. I hate people who use that word. Adam knew what I was struggling with. He nodded at his skinny legs, flexed his hands. A chunk was missing from between the knuckles where he'd had an abscess. The scar was tight and deep. Finn was looking between us. I've got a wee bit of an addiction thing going on, explained Adam, and it's not exactly conducive to honesty in all your affairs. Cohen nodded that he understood. His gaze flitted around the poor room, making sense of it. Anna, no one pays a crew in cash up front. They've got every reason to fuck off. It's hard work, long hours. But Leon did that. So the question is, why would he? Adam laughed at me.
The question is, the fuck are you on about? You investigating it?
Finn was quite excited.
We were listening to the podcast and then I looked at the photo from when they were supposed to be alone on the boat, but it's not a selfie. There had to be someone else on the boat.
Oh, Adam grinned. Like your armchair detectives now.
Yeah, said Finn.
Good for you. He gave a patronising nod to Finn and then looked at me and laughed. The fuck, Sophie? I laughed with him, but calling me Sophie was a stupid slip. I tried to bluster my way out of it. I liked Leon. They say he killed his kids, but I don't think he did. I'm trying to find out what really happened.
Yes, Adam grinned. Sweet, sweet justice.
He knew there was more to it than that. He knew there was a lot more to it, and he waited for me to tell him, nodding a soft prompt. Adam didn't even notice that he'd called me Sophie. Finn had, though. I could see him watching us, waiting for an explanation. Adam's eyebrows were leaping up and down. They both wanted explanations, but I didn't want to tell Adam about Gretchen Tiegler or the other girl. And I didn't want to tell Finn who Sophie was. Adam kept nodding and I nodded along, belligerent, waiting out the awkward moment. Then we both laughed.
Well, I lied. So, you know, what else is there to do on a Monday night?
He laughed at that as well. During all this to and fro and knowing laughter, Finn was just sitting there, taking it all in, thinking. Adam stopped laughing and glanced at Finn and gave me a stern look, telling me not to drag Finn into trouble without telling him what was going on. It was obvious he hadn't a clue. Adam was damaged, but he was also decent.
So, Adam considered the problem, something you might want to think about. A crew won't get on board if there is a sniff that they wouldn't get paid. That's 2 or 3 months of your life.
Sometimes, if the chief is a twat, you worry that they'll dock your wages for, you know, doing things wrong.
Like what? Asked Finn.
Being late back from shore, refusing duties, breaking things, stuff.
He shrugged.
You can end up basically paying them at the end. So would the crew be worried? Was he broke?
Finn said,
or suicidal and liked the crew, that's why he paid in advance.
No, I insisted, he wasn't suicidal. But Finn corrected me.
We can't know that. You hardly knew him.
Adam tipped his head and frowned.
Oh, come on, we've all thought about it.
The crew said he was very calm.
Yeah,
said Adam sadly.
You know, sometimes when people have decided to do it, they're very calm just before. Kind of saintly. I've seen that a few times.
We looked at Adam, a husk of a man. He lived in a high-stakes world. I'd seen him RIP friends on Facebook, always young people, always grinning and blurry photos. He'd saved my life once. He'd probably done it for other people too. His eyebrows rose in a question.
Was Leon broke? Because banks'll freeze your account. Maybe he wanted to make sure the crew got paid and didn't know if the money would be there when he got back.
He wasn't broke, I said. Gretchen's rich.
That doesn't follow, said Finn dismissively.
That kind of annoyed me.
Albert'll know, said Adam. Albert knows who's rich, like I know who's holding. You should go to Skibo and see him. He's still there.
He was right. Albert Mackay would know, but I didn't know if he would tell me. He was manically discreet. It would take some teasing to get it out of him.
Chapter 21. The heat had left the car by the time we got back into it. With the stale smell of cigarette smoke and the burst airbag, it felt like walking back into a party where a lot of regretful things had been said and done. We shut the doors and looked out at Ben Nevis, haughtily ignoring us in the distance.
Why did Adam call you Sophie?
Adam?
Yeah.
Did he?
You know he did.
I didn't hear that.
He called you Sophie.
Oh, that's his ex-girlfriend's name. Finn hummed and hesitated.
I wouldn't have put you two together, to be honest. He's quite... I don't know.
He gave a mini cringe as he did up his seatbelt.
You're quite middle class.
I laughed.
Am I?
Keen to change the subject, I pulled on my seatbelt and said, anyway, I don't think Leon was broke. His wife is one of the richest women in the world.
But they signed prenups.
Even if Leon was broke, I know he wouldn't kill himself.
You can't be sure.
He was being rude again. He didn't even know Leon. Yes, I can. I sounded too adamant, and I couldn't know. Just a few hours ago, I'd nearly done it myself. I think what I was saying was that Leon was a good man. I needed to believe that, but maybe I needed it more back then, when I was so friendless and frightened. This felt like an echo of that time, and I'd survived. Maybe I could...
Anna, you're even lying to yourself now.
Finn, can you shut the fuck up?
He turned to me, and he was smiling. Not the reaction I expected, because I had shouted pretty loud and used a curse and hoped, really, to scare him into being quiet. But it didn't work. He said gently,
look, you're too invested in this. You hardly knew him. What's really going on?
Forget it. I started the engine.
What even is Skibo Castle?
It's a luxury holiday resort in a castle that belonged to Andrew Carnegie. Adam and I worked there. Albert's the manager there. He knew Leon. I pulled the car out into the road. Albert knows everyone. He works in the luxury sector. It's his job to know all the latest gossip about wealthy people. He has an encyclopedic knowledge about them, knows more than the gossip mags ever will. He'll know what people are saying about it.
Why not just phone him and ask him about it?
He's old-fashioned and very well-mannered. He's too discreet to risk talking on the phone.
You're going to ask for reassurance that Leon wouldn't kill his kids?
I'm going to ask about Leon's finances and Gretchen Tiegler. He'll know. I know he will. Finn tapped his fingers on the steering wheel.
Anna, what are we really doing? Are we just running? I'm up for that, by the way, if that's what this is.
I want to clear Leon's name.
And this has to happen now? Today? After what happened this morning? Come on,
he sneered.
Just be honest with me.
Look, I pulled up at the side of the road. I didn't ask you to come with me. Why don't you get out and get a hotel or something? Just go home. Finn sat still, looking out of the window placidly. Then, as if he had just remembered, he took out his tobacco pouch and rolled two cigarettes. He offered me one. I took it. We lit up. I stopped smoking years ago and remembered now how completely disgusting and utterly compelling it was. How my blood pressure rose when I inhaled, and how it made my mood ricochet around. He gestured to the road ahead. Drive.
I think you should get out.
I can get out any time. I'll get out later. Drive.
So I drove and smoked and loved it and wished I wasn't smoking. Really, I don't get why you're still here, Finn. You could have left at the restaurant or got a hotel in Fort William. I waited for him to say some sappy shit about being worried about me. I didn't expect him to say what he did. He exhaled and smacked his lips.
Okay, I couldn't get a hotel because I haven't got tuppence. I can't even use my cards anymore. So either you drive me home or take me with you.
I can give you money to go home.
Do you want me to go home?
I didn't know. I didn't really want to be alone, but he wasn't much fun to fight with, and that was all I had going on at the moment.
Anyway, he said, I've been in hiding for a while, but now people are looking at me again. They're aware of me, and I don't want to seem broken, you know? I need to be doing something, do you know what I mean?
No. I was irritated, and he was excited. It wasn't a good combination.
What I'm saying, I think you know what I'm saying. Let's go on an adventure. Investigate, follow up that thing about who took the picture. I'm thinking we could make a podcast about it. Put it out on Facebook and Twitter.
No!
I found that idea really alarming. I was kind of shouting and driving too fast, trying to frighten him, I think, but he was having none of it. Oh, come on, it'll be fun. The case is interesting.
No! The road was narrow, and I was driving very fast, faster and faster, panicky driving.
Slow down.
He pointed up ahead to a sign warning of sharp turns in the road.
I did slow down.
I mean, why? There's nothing left to say.
You've got enough to say about it. Has anyone asked who took the photo yet? I mean, what if we're good at this? We can live stream and tweet links, it'll be fun.
Look, Finn, you don't listen to podcasts. It can go very far wrong. You accuse the wrong person and they sue you. You can make a mistake in reasoning and get piled on and trolled for it. People will persecute you for having a linguistic tick.
A tick? Like what?
One presenter used to say, hmm, after every second word. Angry, hmm. Going forward, hmm. In other words, hmm. He didn't have a sound engineer to edit it out or tell him. The guy had to leave social media because every time he posted anything, 1,000 people would reply, hmm. It's brutal. Podcasting is like comedy or football. Everyone thinks they know how to do it, but they don't. They don't have a fucking clue. And you need a network to attract an audience. He held up his phone.
We have got an audience. They're waiting for me to say something.
Stupid.
A bigger audience was the last thing I wanted.
You don't know what you're talking about. He was unfazed by me. I think he might have dealt with a lot of aggression from Estelle. She's quite fiery too. It's just a terrible idea, Finn. You have to make them in the studio for sound quality.
Rubbish. Nothing is done in studios anymore. If I put this little mic into the headphone jack, I can get very good quality sound. Look.
He took a small black suede drawstring bag out of his pocket and reached into it, taking out a little mic no bigger than my thumb.
We used this to record song ideas on the road. The sound quality is so good, one guy released an album he recorded with it.
Absolutely not. If you do that, I'll dump you by the side of the road.
Dumped twice in one day.
He brushed a speck of ash from his tweed sleeve.
God, you're so fucking preening.
And that aggravates you.
It does. The buttoned and up to the top, the perfectly buffed shoes. It looks as if you've got nothing to do all day but admire yourself. You're honestly not that good looking.
Personal fashion isn't a celebration, it's a defence. It's the armour of everyday life.
Well, you've got too much fucking armour on. I wasn't being very nice at this point. I was alarmed by the podcast conversation and how blithely Finn had suggested drawing even more attention to us. It wouldn't take a genius to trace me to Finn, and Finn to Estelle, and then find out she had gone to visit her family in Porto with my girls. He sighed, and then out of the blue, he said,
Have you ever heard of Bill Cunningham?
No.
He said that, about fashion being armour. I was thinking about him because he lived above Carnegie Hall.
The Carnegie Hall?
Yeah, in a bedsit. Lived there for decades. They let out rooms above the hall as studio apartments to artists, back when no one wanted to live in New York. He was a fashion photographer. Invented street fashion photography. He was amazing, but never really cashed in on it. He said, They can't tell you what to do if you don't take their money. I like that. I think about him a lot.
Did Estelle like that?
He laughed and looked out of the window. Then he laughed some more.
Poor Estelle. She really didn't know what she was getting into.
I could have said the same about Hamish, but I wasn't as kind as Finn.
We drove and smoked and had another argument about something irrelevant to this story. We were enjoying ourselves. We stopped at a petrol station in Inverness to buy drinks because our mouths were foul from smoking. I made him eat half a chocolate bar and watched while he swallowed it. I told him if he fainted again, I'd stop the car and roll him into a ditch and drive away. He said that seemed quite strict, but entirely fair. Back on the road, we hit the bright suspension bridge across the Murray Firth.
This is so far,
Finn muttered.
I mean, what could a hotel manager possibly know about that's worth going all the way up here for?
I picked up my phone and put on the final episode of the podcast, the Gretchen episode. Chapter 22. Episode 6. What's the deal with Gretchen? In this episode, I want to talk about Gretchen Tiegler and Leon Parker. These murders were committed by someone on board. Leon had the means, the skills, and had orchestrated the situation. He could have done it. To me, that's an obvious observation, but he wasn't investigated. The question is, why? And the answer is almost certainly, Gretchen. Every generation thinks the world will end with them. Whether it's the Black Death, Judgment Day, or nuclear war to wipe them out, humans have a hard time imagining a world going on after their death. Maybe because if the world does just rumble on, nothing we do really matters anyway. We're not that important. But some people are. Gretchen Tiegler might be. Her money, her history, her connections are so extensive that when she dies, the world might just give up and fold in on itself, because Gretchen is a direct consequence of many of the major events of the 20th century. She was born at the crossroads between two great fortunes and, aged just 23, inherited more money than the GDP of half the world's states. Unlike most rich kids, Gretchen hasn't spent and enjoyed her money. In fact, in the years since she inherited, she has tripled her fortune through aggressive deals and questionable investments, using methods most people would balk at. She is an extraordinary woman. She is fantastically rich and never ever speaks to the press. She never has. She refused to even appear in her school yearbook. When she graduated from high school, she submitted a photo of Eleanor Roosevelt, looking particularly toothsome instead. That was prescient for a 17-year-old in late 1980s California. But she had good reason to be wary of public attention. Rich kids were being kidnapped all over the world, and the Tieglers were loathed. She had three generations of reasons to be wary. It began like this. In around 1900, a small German man left his hometown of Weil in Freiburg and walked to Paris. There he set up shop and began selling face cream. A lot of people sold face cream, the market was crowded. But Otto Tiegler had discovered, long before it was well known, what is now called the Veblen principle.
If Otto made his face cream shockingly expensive, then people would buy it as a status symbol. What the cream did or didn't do wasn't really important. They weren't really buying cream. They were buying exclusivity. Women who could afford the cream wanted to boast about having it. Men bought it as ostentatious gifts for wives and lovers. Celebrities wanted to be associated with the cream and were happy for their names to be used in endorsements. Otto understood the forces at play well enough to keep the formula secret. He built and advertised a laboratory where chemists were paid high salaries to develop new products. His face cream outsold all others, and Otto Tiegler made a fortune, which he used to promote his one true passion, fascism. German Nazism recruited from the working classes, but Tiegler's fascism was a Veblen product. He made it exclusive. At first, he established a league of prominent well-to-do right-wingers. They hosted elaborate fundraising dinners, balls, concerts. These rich, glamorous people then attracted an army of less wealthy but socially aspiring supporters. They, in turn, brought in even less wealthy supporters, until the League had an army of impoverished, angry blackshirts. 1930s France was awash with immigrants. From the south came 500,000 Spanish refugees fleeing the Civil War. From the north and east came Jews, driven from their homes by Nazis and pogroms. Otto Tiegler provided the French government with vast funds to repatriate the Jews to Germany. He started a newspaper designed to incite violence against Jews and the Spanish. Following the Nazis' invasion, Tiegler became a prominent supporter of the appeasing Vichy government. Then the war began, and we all know how that went. But the aftermath of the war was telling. Soldiers begin fighting for a cause and finish fighting for their comrades. This was no different. After the war, Tiegler's main concern was for his fascist League brothers. In the chaos and recrimination of peace, when any woman who accepted a drink from a German soldier was punishment raped or had her head shaved in public, Tiegler and his comrades protected each other. France needed investment, and Tiegler Inc. built factories. It employed fellow League members to run a workforce made up of the Black Shirt Army, and over the following two decades, Tiegler Inc. blossomed into a worldwide brand. Otto and his wife Thérèse had one child, a daughter named Françoise. She had grown up in the belly of the regime. Now 18, Françoise attended smart parties and movie premieres, was pictured waving from airplane steps at glamorous locations. Everything she did was a Tiegler Inc. endorsement because the tagline always read, "Sole heir to the Tiegler fortune." Then, abruptly, in 1961, Françoise dropped out of view. No one in the Tiegler camp ever mentioned her again. This is what happened to her. While attending a house party in Monte Carlo, Françoise turned down an invitation to a night at the casino. There were 20 or so people in the group, and everyone was keen to go, except for Françoise and one other guest. She was bored of the casino, and the other guest, a young man her own age, didn't approve of gambling. They were left alone for the evening. He was unlike any man she had ever met. He was intriguing, had a lot of unfamiliar ideas about politics and the history of Europe. He was from a wealthy Chicago family. His name was Freddie Klersch, and he was a rabbi. Less than a week later, Françoise and Freddie ran away to California together. They were married for 27 years. The Klersch family were just as conflict-ridden as the Tieglers. These Chicago industrialists were a vast, fractured clan who sued and countersued each other over trivialities. Françoise and Freddie stayed out of it. They lived modestly, happily, and had only one child. They named her Gretchen. Growing up in San Diego, Gretchen had no contact with her grandparents. Her parents died within a year of each other, father of a degenerative muscular condition, mother of a stroke, leaving her alone in the world aged just 22. She has always been intensely private, which is what makes her first and only foray into public life so strange. Her grandmother, Therese Tegeler, was widowed and elderly when her estranged daughter died. 79-year-old Therese Tegeler could not attend the funeral because her young boyfriend was jealous and didn't like her going out of the house. Therese met Anton von Bühler at a charity fete. 26 and very handsome, he was working as a waiter for the catering company. At the end of the fete, Anton helped 79-year-old Therese from her wheelchair into her car, climbed in next to her, and they went home. 6 months later, he was still in the house and boasted that his bank account was hundreds of thousands of francs heavier. This is a problem most of us do not have. The super rich are surrounded by flies. They attract predators. It is both a hazard of being very rich and what motivates others to get very rich. The dying super rich attract more flies than most, or maybe they don't have the energy to bat them off. Some are blind to the complexity of those relationships, but some aren't. Some like it. For some people, these power differentials are a reason to get rich. Therese seemed to enjoy it. She didn't leave the house anymore because Anton didn't want her to. Her staff called the police, but they couldn't remove von Bühler because Therese said she wanted him there. Her lawyers tried to have him evicted, but she had signed a letter consenting to him doing whatever he wanted in the house. Then von Bühler began removing artworks from the house and keeping them in his own storage unit. He said they were redecorating. A rumour began that she had changed her will, disinheriting Gretchen and making von Bühler her sole heir. Gretchen was 23 at this point. She had never met her grandmother, but hearing of Therese's intentions, she flew to Paris on her own initiative. She waited until von Bühler was out and had the butler let her in to visit her grandmother. Gretchen quietly drank her tea and talked to her grandmother about the weather and holidays and health, while all over the house, a private security firm planted cameras and microphones. 2 weeks later, Gretchen returned, retrieved all of the equipment, and released the footage, unedited, to the media. That was a strange choice. There were blowjobs between members of staff, drinking, pilfering. She could at least have cut the footage of Therese being washed by a nurse or using the commode, but she didn't. Those intimate episodes were not what caught the press's attention, though. The film showed bankers and accountants coming and talking to a confused Therese about her accounts, her tax liability, and her offshore investments. Therese was dodging tax on a massive scale and had been for decades. The Teglers had finally done something to offend the French. Things moved quickly then. Therese's new will was nullified by a judge, and von Bühler was charged with abus de faiblesse, conning a frail person. He was made to give everything back. The money, the shares, the art. Ironically, the most valuable pieces in the Teegler art collection were by two Spanish asylum seekers and an Italian Jew, Picasso, Dali, and Modigliani. Everyone who worked for Therese was sacked and replaced. She was dead within 4 months, and in accordance with the reverted will, Gretchen inherited everything. She was fabulously wealthy, on paper at least. When she moved into the Teegler mansion in Neuilly-sur-Seine, she discovered that von Bühler was not the first handsome adventurer with his hand in the pot. There was very little left, and they were running everything through the books. Offshore accounts were frozen and back taxes were billed. Gretchen was suddenly not very wealthy at all. She set about rebuilding the fortune with the help of her legal advisers. The firm she chose had taken over an Italian football club in administration. Now Gretchen decided to invest in football, Her career in football finance has been controversial, to say the least. One Italian club dissolved into insolvency 6 months after she withdrew her investment, and the pension fund was found to be all but empty. This happened several times, twice in Greece, once in a minor league Spanish club. Football finance is a strange grey area. Although heavily regulated, the large sums generated sometimes mean that unscrupulous investors are attracted to it, using shell companies and accounting tricks. So, this next part is very difficult to discuss. Legally, the suggestion of one fact causing another fact cannot be implied, or we could be sued. So this part has been phrased carefully by our lawyer, and I am now going to read it out to you, word for word. 12 years ago, a young PA called Dauphine Loire came to work for Gretchen Tiegler. Loire has barely left her side since. The two women are very close. Unrelated to this, around the same time, a whistleblower in a Spanish football club made allegations about financial irregularities. Despite events which might, cumulatively, be regarded as a campaign of intimidation, the man continued to make allegations online and in interviews with local journalists. The whistleblower claimed to work for the accounting firm which audited the football club. Fact 2. This whistleblower was threatened with legal action by the parent company of the football club. Fact 3. The man died. His house caught fire, but an unexpected torrential rainstorm quenched the flames. Fire investigators found his body only partially burned. At post-mortem, he was found to have been murdered before the fire began. His throat was cut. If the freak storm had not extinguished the fire, the murder would never have been uncovered. That murder remains unsolved. Unrelated to that fact is this. A well-known print publication was sued last year for wrongfully speculating about that death. That print publication lost their case, paid damages, and has now ceased to exist. It was the closest thing I had ever heard to outright allegations against Gretchen Tiegler. Trina Keeney was either very brave or very stupid. It was a small-time podcast. She probably didn't have access to a legal department. If she had an editor or a parent company protecting their capital, she would have been stopped from saying it. I thought she was making a dangerous mistake. But we are not going into all of that. That's nothing to do with our story. Anyway, this was ancient history when Leon and Gretchen started going out together. They were 57 and 48 respectively, had moved in the same social circles for some time before they were romantically involved. They were married in Paris. There were two witnesses, a PA, Dauphine Loire, and a secretary in the office of Le Marié. Gretchen didn't respond to press inquiries about her wedding. Leon said they had got married and were very happy. It took everyone by surprise. No one even knew they were dating. This was no marriage of convenience. It changed both of their lives fundamentally. In the first few months of their marriage, Gretchen was being seen in public and even attended a couple of parties. She began to travel for pleasure, always with Leon. They visited Switzerland and India. They travelled to Freiburg, met distant family, and they went out to Parisian restaurants in public. That is to say, she didn't have them shut down for a private meal, but ate in front of other people, with other people, apparently at Leon's behest. Leon put his Sandbanks house on the market, asking price, 21 million. He was moving to Paris to live with Gretchen. If Leon was good for her, Gretchen seems to have been a good influence on him too. He had always been an absent father, but he now made time to see Violetta and Mark away from their mothers, sometimes with Gretchen, sometimes alone. They developed relationships. Both kids admitted that these interactions were not easy. They were getting to know each other, working through resentments and difficulties. Violetta seems to have found it particularly hard. There was a lot to get over. She told friends that she didn't like him. He was vulgar and dumb and stupid. But Leon persisted. Is it possible that these lifestyle changes got too much for Leon? He was in his late 50s. Gretchen was in her late 40s. Change is hard. Leon seemed to be reviewing his life, picking over everything that had happened to him. What if he didn't like what he saw? Could he have been suicidal but afraid of leaving his kids behind? There was no guarantee that Gretchen would support them. It is fair to say that Gretchen is attention shy and the exposure of an investigation into Leon's death may have seemed too much. She didn't apply for the generous insurance on the Dana, perhaps to avoid the exposure of opening the case again. Or maybe she is just the richest woman in the world, was grief-stricken, and asked her staff to overlook the debt. Neither the police nor the press approached her. It was as if she had been cut out of the story altogether. There are so many threads left hanging in this case. In an interview given to a German TV network, a local Saint Martin man, who rented his Airbnb room to Mark Parker the night before the Dana arrived, was walking on the dock on the night of the sinking. He told the reporter that he saw a girl in a stripy dress cast off the ship. He said she had long, blonde hair. This interview has now disappeared from the TV company archives and was only ever mentioned on Reddit by people who saw it broadcast at the time. Emila and Sabina had saved only one third of their stake to open a bakery. Just months after Emila is convicted, Sabina opens a bakery. And what happened to the diamond necklace? That was never mentioned again. I said at the beginning of this series that when you look at the facts of this case, the court's findings were impossible. This is what I think happened. I think Leon deliberately orchestrated that night so that he was alone with his two kids. He could sail. He knew the Dana. He had access to the engine room and could have planted the explosives. He also had access to the food and the champagne. He planted the explosives and drugged the champagne. Then he told Mark to go downstairs, maybe got Violetta to cast off and go downstairs while he stayed in the wheelhouse. I think he piloted the ship out to sea and set the course. If the drugs were starting to have an effect, he may have become confused and forgotten the radio and the lights. I think he got the kids into the dining room, closed the door, served the food, and after they all passed out, the explosives in the engine room finished the job. Leon killed his kids and himself that night. Sad, but obvious. Gretchen Tiegler may have been grieving, she may have been heartbroken, but so are all family members when a murder happens. Whether she made it explicit or implicit, the sheer power of her name directed all of the investigation away from her and those around her. Because of that, an innocent woman languishes in jail. Emila Fabricasse will be 61 before she gets out of prison. Her partner Sabina is standing by her. Thanks for joining us for this true crime series here on the Miso Network. Do you enjoy cooking with Fast and Fresh? I switched it off. What? Asked Finn. It was only then that I realised I'd been muttering to myself. I tutted. Tiegler.
Dreadful, he said. Why did she do that to her grandmother?
Well, that's just a taster. Trust me, she's done much worse.
Like what?
There was too much to tell and we were fast approaching Skibo Castle.
Look, I said.
Finn sat up as we took the turn from the main road. The estate wall was low. We could see into the perfectly maintained grounds and buildings. I could almost smell the money, or at least the absence of other smells, which is perhaps what money really smells like. Chapter 23. I drew up at the barrier and pressed the intercom. Having worked there, I knew what would be happening inside. The security manager in the steward's hall would be checking the bookings and sign-outs. Probably using an iPad now, but it was an actual book in my time. He or she might be frowning, wondering who it could be at 11:30 on a Monday night. Check-ins tend